Welcome. I'm Bibi McKenna, and I am an occupational therapy graduate student at the University of New Mexico. In this occupational therapy podcast, we are talking about children and mealtimes. My guest today is Dr. Joanna Cosby. She is a professor of occupational therapy at the University of New Mexico and has been an occupational therapist for 16 years, working to help children with severe disabilities, alternative communication needs, and sensory processing issues. Good morning.
Good morning.
Joanna, today I'd like to start out by asking you, why is it important to talk about mealtimes?
Yes, mealtimes are extremely relevant. They're something that everybody does multiple times a day, and they're just for family connections and for each of us as a human. So it's important for family relationships. If you think about the amount of time that we spend with our families around preparing meals, eating meals together, it's important for parents and children together to establish relationships around meals. There are some different mealtime patterns that we have here in the U.S. compared to other places, and that makes feeding difficulties more prevalent. And that's actually the area I work in, supporting people who have challenging mealtime issues with their children.
So what are some tips that can help families improve their mealtime experience?
Like I said, it's not at all uncommon for families of kids with and without disabilities to run into some difficulties during mealtime. But there are some things that people can do to make it a little bit easier. For example, I'm a strong advocate for having your children involved in every aspect of a mealtime. So from the time they're infants, having them around when you're preparing meals, having them around and participating, whether they're breastfed or bottle fed, just involving them in that process. As soon as they're old enough to sit up or be in a supported seat, you can have the children participating in the actual mealtime with the family. So again, that's assuming that you eat meals as a family. And I know in this crazy day and age, we don't all sit down and eat a traditional meal, but we're all eating at some point during the day and just finding a way to include your children in that. One thing to think about is normalizing food in general. Here in the United States, we have kids' menus, for example, that other cultures and communities don't have. That sets up this idea that the food that kids eat should be different than the food that adults eat. And what we actually find is that that's not at all the case. Kids eat what they're exposed to and what they have experience with. So, for example, my son, when he was 2, asked for broccoli from Santa Claus for Christmas because that was part of what we did. We didn't have this idea that he ate only chicken nuggets and spaghetti and only pizza. So, again, exposing them to things, being cognizant of the fact that kids are probably going to resist food when it's brand new. That's a typical part of development, especially when they're, you know, 18 months to 2 years old. And they're figuring out their own independence, it's really easy for them to say, no, I'm not going to eat that. And that's a battle that we're not going to win if we try and force them to eat it. But what we need to recognize is they're not saying, I don't like that. They're saying, I don't know what this is, and I'm a little bit afraid of it, and I'm trying to express that autonomy. So presenting foods many, many, many times. The research shows that kids without disabilities might need a food presented to them 20 to 25 times before they'll accept it. If we're looking at children who are picky eaters, that can go up exponentially. Mm-hmm. So, again, just helping families understand, just keep putting it out there. Just keep putting it out there. And even if the kid only touches it, that's one step towards actually eating that food. The other thing to think about is that kids grow and change. So if your child's refusing something at 2 or at 3 years old, keep offering it, because it could be by the time they hit 4, 5, 6, 7, at some point they might say, you know what, this is okay. Recognizing that kids may not want to take a bite of something right away is really important. So what we actually work for is interaction and exposure to foods. So have it on their plate, tell them it's totally okay if you don't eat it. But then when it's time to clean up the plate, have them help you put it in the trash. Maybe have them pick it up with their fingers to put it in the trash, or if you can get there, even give it a kiss before they put it in the trash. You would be astonished how many times kids pick something up, see if anyone's looking, and then take a quick taste of it before they put it in the trash. So that can be a really nice way to just get a little sampling of something. And the other thing is just looking at natural consequences. So again, we're going to always lose if we try to force a child to eat. As parents, our job is not to force. It's to provide healthy, appropriate choices for them. Their job is to decide whether or not they're going to consume it. So I put out a nice, healthy meal for my children. My child decides he's not going to eat it. I'm not going to win if I try to force him to eat it. But what I can do is say, okay, then when you want cookies later or you want goldfish crackers later, you're not going to get those.
I remember that when I was a kid, my parents would not let me have dessert until I finished my spinach.
Right. And we call that a natural consequence. It's not a punishment. We're not saying you were a bad kid because you didn't eat your spinach, you can't have ice cream. What we're saying is if you're not hungry enough for spinach, then you're not hungry enough for ice cream. Kids learn very quickly, well, that kind of makes sense. I better eat my spinach, and then I get to have my ice cream later. We aren't advocates for doing things like taking away television or making a child sit at the table until they're done. We need to allow the child to express, I want to eat or I don't want to eat, but then not give in later and give them lots of snacks.
So what happens if the child chooses not to eat and they don't have any dinner?
That's okay. Most kids, and again, we're talking about kids who don't have special health care needs that we should be aware of, most kids can afford to miss a meal or two. So what we do is encourage 3 meals and 2 snacks a day. So if you present dinner and the child doesn't eat their dinner, that's okay. You know they're going to have breakfast presented the next morning. If they don't eat breakfast, they've got a snack coming up. But again, the challenge for parents then is ensuring that what they're providing at those meals and snacks is high-quality food, not junk food to tide the child over because they're worried they're not eating.
So what it sounds like to me could be a challenge for parents is their own fear. A parent could become afraid, potentially, that the child might go to school the next day and say, I didn't have breakfast at home. And people might judge them for not having provided their child food when actually they did provide their child food, but their child refused, and they're simply trying to change a behavior. How would you respond to that?
That is an incredibly salient concern. So as parents, and I didn't completely understand this until I became a parent, we are driven to make sure our kids' needs are met. And feeding is an extremely sensitive topic between, you know, parents and their children. And there is that societal perception of if you don't feed your child, you're doing something wrong. Helping parents recognize it really is okay if the child's just missing a meal or two. Helping them feel empowered to tell other people, here's the deal. Yes, he didn't have breakfast this morning, but it's because I offered him a healthy breakfast and all he wanted to eat was junk food. We've determined in our family that that's not okay. So when you present it like that, I think people would be hard-pressed to judge you and say, oh my gosh, what a terrible mom you are because you didn't feed your child, when really the issue is you offered your child food. They just chose not to eat it. And then, you know, reassuring, but I packed him some nice healthy snacks in his lunchbox that he can have at 10 o'clock this morning. He's going to be okay.
Is there any research indicating how long it takes a child's behavior to change?
It really depends on how long that behavior has persisted and what the other dynamics are around the relationship. But in general, it can take, for kids without a whole lot of other issues, it can take, you know, up to 2 weeks. Typically doesn't take that long. Once a child learns mom means business, she's not going to give me that ice cream even if I hold my breath and turn blue in the face, pretty quickly, within just a few days, they'll typically start to eat. And what you might have to do is do it slowly and say, I don't need you to eat a whole serving of spinach, but let's have a bite. And then in a few days, okay, now we've got to work on 2 bites of spinach before you can be done, or that type of thing.
Or how would a parent respond if the child gives that gag reflex, they start gagging over their food? Sometimes I can imagine that a parent would reinforce a child's negative response to food if they become emotional themselves.
It's hard as a parent to watch your child be uncomfortable. Gagging is a natural human response. Gagging's good. It keeps us healthy. It keeps us safe. It's not uncommon when a child's experiencing a new food that they're not really comfortable with for them to have that gag reaction. Parents can respond one of two ways. A very common way for parents to respond is, oh my gosh, he's gagging, and they rip the food, take it away, they clean up the mess, they make kind of a big deal about it. What that tends to do to the child is gets the child more anxious and more worried about the fact that they gagged. They don't recognize that gagging's normal. Gagging happens. It's okay. So what we try to encourage instead is for the parents to say, oh man, you kind of gagged on that, but you did a great job recovering. You're going to be okay. And even if on the inside the parents are thinking, oh my gosh, this kid gagged, on the outside they need to just send the message, it's okay, you can do it. I know a lot of the kids we work with in research, there's one little girl in particular who has a very strong gag reflex. And we taught her to clear her throat and move on. By the end, probably after about 3 or 4 weeks of practicing that strategy, she'd gag, she'd clear her throat and say, I did it, I can do this. And she had this huge sense of pride that she could work through that without having the panic response herself and from everybody around her.
Well, that's exciting. How about changes over time? If a child refuses a food when they're three, are they still going to refuse the food when they're seven? Should you try again?
You should absolutely try again. But what I would encourage is don't wait until they're seven to try again. Keep trying all the way along, and one day they're going to surprise you and say, I'll at least take a taste of it. I may not like it, but I'll try it. The child says no to something when they're three, and then you just never expose them to that again until they're seven, it's going to be a lot harder for them to start trying, to feel comfortable trying it or eating it than it would if you didn't wait and if you just kept presenting it. For example, every time you had spinach, the child had a little bit on his or her plate. That's going to work better than helping them avoid it for 4 years.
You mentioned that it could take 20 times or 20 presentations of a food to a child who's not dealing with multiple issues to potentially try that food. If a child is dealing with issues, about how many presentations could it take before that child begins to think, maybe I'll give it a try?
That's dependent on each child's individual situation. Kids who have feeding difficulties fall in a bunch of different categories. Some of them are kids who are otherwise typically developing, but just tend to be what we call really picky eaters. Other kids have some neurological differences, like they may be really averse to the taste or the texture of different things. Other children have disorders such as autism that make them more likely to be picky eaters. And then we have kids who maybe they were born prematurely or had other health issues that meant they didn't get early experiences with eating by mouth. Maybe they had a feeding tube or other types of feeding that didn't involve actually putting food in your mouth and eating. All of those situations are going to impact how long it takes for a child to get to a point where they're willing to accept a food. And it's also going to impact the interventions that we try, whether we try more what we call sensory-based interventions, so getting comfortable with touching and exploring the food, or more behavioral interventions such as, hey, take a taste, and then I'll let you have a little bite of this treat that you like.
Joanna, this is great information. Where can a parent go to learn more information if they are having these challenges in their home?
I would recommend the first place to start is to talk to your child's pediatrician. Pediatricians may or may not be able to provide you with the information you need to help your child in your own home, but if you specifically request a referral to an occupational therapist, they should be able to connect you with someone who can provide you some support.
Wonderful. For additional information, our listeners can also visit the New Mexico Occupational Therapy Association's website and the American Occupational Therapy Association's website. We have those links embedded in the KUNM webpage in which you found this podcast. Joanna, thank you for joining us today. We really appreciate your contribution. It was very interesting.
Thanks for having me.